Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Social media apps like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram have become constants in our culture. Instagram has had some unusual effects. Consider this. There is a corner in Dumbo that has become a tourist destination just to get the picture for the gram. In one afternoon, the folks at New York Magazine counted that there were 194 pictures of people posing at that corner. One was liked 6,960 times. There were visitors from seven countries. Two quinceañera celebrations took professional photos, as did two wedding parties. Sure, Insta is fun. Of course, it helped give birth to the selfie. But most of us have no idea about the Shakespearean drama behind the emergence of this company. From a ruined friendship and aggressive mergers and a ruthless pursuit of domination. Sarah Fryer knows all about it. She's been following the sagas of Silicon Valley for years as Bloomberg's technology reporter. In her new book, No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram, she gives the reader a behind-the-scenes look at the rise of America's most popular photo-sharing app, which started as an earnest and independent embrace of all things artful and cultured, but was ultimately taken over by social media behemoth Facebook in an unprecedented $1 billion acquisition. The New York Times says the book, quote, pairs phenomenal in-depth reporting with explosive storytelling that gets to the heart of how Instagram has shaped all of our lives, whether you use the app or not. And Kirkus Review says No Filter, quote, portrays the clash between company values as well as the rise of Instagram's bizarre celebrity culture. Sarah, welcome to All of It.
Thank you for having me.
So the book is set in Silicon Valley itself. And Silicon Valley is one of those places that it's like a character. I know that's a cliche, but it's true. It's like a character in the book. Can you give us an idea of what makes it different than other places as far as the culture and the people who end up starting businesses there?
Well, one of the most shocking things in the early days of Instagram is before it even started, Kevin Systrom, the CEO, had already met / worked for all of these other Silicon Valley luminaries. And it really gives you the sense of how small that world is. For example, in 2005, he rejected a job offer from Mark Zuckerberg for thefacebook.com, which is like the web-only, wall-only version of Facebook. He also interned for Odeo in 2006, which later went on to create Twitter. That's where he befriended Jack Dorsey, back when Jack Dorsey was just getting his first real important engineering job. And so Jack Dorsey, of course, today is the co-founder and CEO of Twitter. And so it's just really incredible to see all of these people intersecting and learning from each other. And it ends up being important for Kevin Systrom because he realizes all of these people that are put on a pedestal, I know them. They're just people. I could, even though I'm not an engineer, even though I'm not a computer programmer in the hacker sense, you know, I have instincts, I have ideas, I could make an app that is popular. And so he ends up building Bourbon, which later transitions into Instagram, just based on his instincts about what people might want on their mobile phone.
How typical are the founders of Instagram? You mentioned Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger. Are they classic Silicon Valley guys?
Well, in some ways, yes, because they went to Stanford, which is, you know, of course, this farm for entrepreneurs, or it has become known as that. And Kevin Systrom interned at Google, Mikey Krieger interned at Microsoft. But in another sense, not at all, because Kevin Systrom, he wasn't even a computer programmer. He was more interested in art and culture. He was a DJ. He went and studied abroad in Florence, where he delved deep into photography. He really appreciated fine things like nice bourbon and fashion, things like that you wouldn't really connect with this hoodie stereotype of a Silicon Valley engineer. And Mike Krieger, you know, he was a Brazilian immigrant and he didn't really have the same path to success as others did. But he was very good at thinking about engineering, and he's also a musician, and he had this appreciation for art and culture as well. And so together, I think they built something where they weren't trying to make the most technically complex and impressive product. They were just trying to make something that made sense for regular people to use.
Yeah, that first incarnation, bourbon, of course, without a vowel, B-U-R-B-N, it was too complex. It was too confusing. So they went the route of, they pivoted to this idea of Instagram, of these pictures, and it was sort of an artisanal sort of ethos is what they were going for originally, sort of the creative, about the art of the picture. What were some of the guiding principles early on of the app Instagram?
Well, they wanted to solve one problem and solve it well. So they realized that with people starting to buy iPhones, the iPhone had just started to become more mainstream popular. The photos on the iPhone weren't great. They were grainy. They had leaky light or darkness. And Sistrom, with his photography background, could build filters to make them better. So that was part one. But they also wanted it to load really fast. Another big frustration with mobile photos was, you know, they just took forever to post. And so they tried to strip it down to its most basic parts. People would only get to do a square. It would be as a low quality version of a high quality photo, so that it would go up really quickly. And they wanted to make it as simple as possible. They didn't want all of the flourishes of Facebook, the events, the groups, the newsfeed, the algorithm. They just wanted a simple place where people could post and see other people's posts. There weren't even any comments or hashtags or anything back then.
My guest is Sarah Fryer. The name of her book is No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram. Just as a sidebar, I mean, I think Facebook is well known for NDAs. And, you know, to even go inside, you have to sign an NDA. How were you able to report this story?
Well, I think it's really about relationships. I've built my understanding of social media companies over the course of covering this sector of our economy for almost a decade at Bloomberg. And in understanding that people, when they're building these products, it is not just about uncovering what's next or uncovering the thing that they're not supposed to talk about in their NDA, but also about the emotion around what they're doing and the motivations around what they're doing. And a book is an opportunity to delve into those questions, mm-hmm. why things happened the way they did. Getting people to talk, I mean, that is, you know, as well as I do, that is really about establishing trust, about understanding the context of what you're asking about, and trying to think of this story not just as a story about technology, but also as a story about that technology's impact on the people who built it, on the people who use it, and on our culture at large. And so I think just really asking questions. Some people who I interviewed for this book had never spoken to a journalist about some of these things that happened at Instagram. And it was their first opportunity to discuss it in detail, and it was almost therapeutic.
So one of the interesting things is Instagram is almost an immediate success. From reading your book, it sounds like it caught them off guard. In many ways, there were only about a dozen people working there when it started to grow into be this huge app. So if you can explain for our audience, what would happen if, say, some huge star, some early adopter like Justin Bieber posted something?
Oh, the entire thing would go down. Justin Bieber, basically, they had to have an entire server or half server dedicated to his activity, because whenever he would post, an alarm would go off on Mike Krieger's phone, telling him that the servers needed to be reset. And he brought along his entire audience to the app. And that's really how Instagram grew in the beginning. There were people who joined who brought their audiences from other social platforms or pure celebrity with them to Instagram, and then started using Instagram as a sort of pure representation of what they were seeing as they went about their lives. It became very irresistible. But yes, whenever Justin Bieber posted, boom, it would go crash.
So they were approached regularly by people who wanted to become involved, invested perhaps by them. Even Jack Dorsey, who was one of the first Instagram users and ambassadors. Why didn't Kevin and Mike sell initially?
They didn't want to they didn't want Instagram to become subsumed by another company. Twitter initially offered to purchase the company, but they didn't make the most appealing offer. They said, oh, you could come and maybe you could run Twitter products as well, and we could use Instagram as the best way to post photos on Twitter. And that wasn't really, you have to understand that if you are an entrepreneur building something in Silicon Valley, there's a lot of vision and ego tied up into that choice. You are holding on to a rocket ship, and you think that you've brought some magic to the process. And so it wasn't until Mark Zuckerberg in 2012 approached the founders and said, listen, if you join Facebook, not only will I give you $1 billion, which no one had ever paid for a mobile application before, but I'll let you remain founders. I'll let you be CEO. I'll let you run your company independently within Facebook. I wouldn't even bother you. And you can have access to Facebook's talent pool. You can have access to Facebook's infrastructure. I know you're having problems with all those Justin Bieber posts. And we can let you thrive the way you want to thrive. And that was extremely appealing to the founders. They almost couldn't say no. It was like, do you want to be still be in charge, but have none of the risk?
But one of the things that comes through loud and clear in the book is that there was this huge culture clash between Facebook and its goals and what was important to it, and Instagram and its goals and its founders and its principles. How were they different?
Facebook was so intent on growth at all costs. They measure every aspect of our behavior, how we scroll, what we click on, what we like, even the things that we type and don't send, and they measure it all, and they try to tweak their product ever so slightly to increase our activity on their platform. Whereas Instagram has tried to appeal to us through their taste and curation. They've tried to surface things that we may not have otherwise discovered and make sure that we are able to find them. And very different growth philosophies. Instagram rejected a lot of the Facebook tactics like notifications, the recommendation engine about who else you should follow, all of this personalization that Facebook does, because Instagram wanted you to discover new things on Instagram that maybe you weren't expecting. And over time, that clash came to a head because Instagram was still able to grow into a dramatically powerful company doing it their way. And Facebook ended up getting into trouble for their size and power and influence over our society.
This thing you're talking about, Cambridge Analytica. Yeah, it was interesting in the book how Instagram, even though it was, owned by Facebook, did not, some of the bad press and some of the bad feelings about Facebook didn't seem to transfer onto Instagram. Why was that?
I think it was the greatest benefit of the acquisition for them, which is that they, even though, they were frustrated at that time about some of Facebook's intentions to take control of their products and their audience, they didn't have to, Kevin Systrom never had to testify in front of Congress. They never had to answer to the Senate questions about Russian influence in the election because Facebook could take all of that. Facebook was the lightning rod for all of that criticism. And so I think that we really as a society have not delved into the negative consequences of Instagram's growth and the ways in which it's, we talked about this artistic culture creation sense of the word, but Instagram has also had some negative effects on our society, and those are not widely explored by regulators or by us.
For example, what would be some of those?
Well, so there are little things that they decided in the very beginning that then turned into problems. For example, the filters that I talked about. Those were initially a way to make our photos look better. But eventually they sort of trained us to accept that everything on Instagram has been polished or curated or made better than reality. And we scroll through our Instagrams and we compare ourselves to other people, not understanding the extent to which they have changed their content or curated their content to help us perceive them in that way that they we have all become so strategic about our Instagram presence to the extent that people are faking it till they make it on the app. People are you know, buying comments. I don't know if you know, but you can buy comments, you can buy engagement, you can just present yourself as more successful or interesting than you actually are. Furthermore, there are big issues with the content on Instagram, like the same kind of darkness that you see on Facebook, illegal drug sales, violent content, child trafficking, all of these things that are buried in hashtag communities and buried in places that where the content is not going viral, but it is still growing an audience on Instagram and is not going to be found unless somebody reports it to the company. And so I think that the company has become an afterthought, not just for regulators and for us in terms of its downsides, but also at Facebook. Facebook Inc. cares more about solving the Facebook main app problems than they think about the Instagram problems. And for an app with more than a billion users and 20 billion plus in revenue, and that's a lot to be an afterthought.
The two Instagram founders, they've had it. They decide to leave. They leave very quickly, and not shortly after they leave. It's very interesting. You see on Instagram when you log on now, a Facebook company, which wouldn't have happened when they were there. What are they up to, the original founders of Instagram? What are they doing now?
They're actually working on a coronavirus tracking website. They have tried to boil it down to this one number, the virus reproduction rate, and they're organizing it by state. So if you go to their website, rt.live, you will see states coded by red or green based on how likely a person who is infected there is likely to spread it to other people. So what they're hoping is that when economies start to open up, we can use their website to track whether that is increasing the danger and whether things should be shut back down again. It's kind of interesting. Kevin Systrom said it's not their next company. They're just doing this because they're experimenting. I don't think they've figured out what they want to do long-term professionally just yet. But I think that they will perhaps think again before they sell. That was a pretty emotional experience for them to have their company taken into a deeper control by Facebook.
It's a fascinating read as a story about business, as a story about personalities. The name of the book is No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram. Sarah Fryer, thank you so much for joining us on All of It today.
Thanks for having me.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.